I am going to talk about some general things about impeachment that you may or may not be aware of, but which I think are rather interesting. And then I'll move on to talk about particularly the presidential impeachments and near impeachment in American history, the four cases, Johnson, Nixon, Clinton, and then we'll finish by talking about the impeachment and forthcoming Senate trial of President Trump. A bit of, you know, Americans don't think comparatively often enough about their politics. And so I thought it would be interesting to start by putting impeachment in some comparative context. There are actually 28 countries that have a provision for impeachment or something that looks rather like impeachment in their constitutions. And they're listed there. It's some interesting, I love the French name for the process, La Destitution. It's wonderfully French. That is their impeachment process. A lot of these countries have never used it or come close to using it, but here are three examples, I guess, in the modern era of presidents, heads of state, who were actually removed through an impeachment process. Two of these have occurred in Brazil. The first was Fernando Collor de Mello, who was president of Brazil. He was a very dashing, immaculately coiffed individual, and very young when he became president of Brazil. And he was impeached, removed in 1992, and then I lived in Miami at the time, and what do Latin American presidents who've been removed do? They move to Miami. So President Collor moved to Miami, and he was an item on sort of the Miami social scene. The city has quite a large Brazilian community. I believe he subsequently moved back to Brazil and resumed his political career. More recently, Dilma Rousseff, she was impeached and removed in 2016 on allegations of budgetary mismanagement. That's kind of interesting. Brazilian politics also has had a fair degree of polarization in recent years, as you might be aware. And then finally, President Park of South Korea in 2016, another female president was impeached by the country's National Assembly, and that was confirmed by the Constitutional Court there, which does the trial part of their process. So those are three examples of heads of state that have been removed through impeachment proceedings in the last quarter century or so, two of them within the last 5 years. So it is not unprecedented to have heads of state being removed by impeachment. And America is by no means unique in having impeachment process in its constitution. The origins. The origins of impeachment, or at least the American version of impeachment, are English. I say English specifically. I'm Scottish, but I don't believe the Scots had impeachment. But medieval England, or late medieval England, introduced impeachment basically as a device to try to control the king. You remember King John and Magna Carta and Parliament setting up, you know, a sort of division of power between the king and Parliament. And impeachment was a device to try to hold the king to account by going after the king's ministers. They couldn't go after the king himself or herself, but they could go after the ministers, and they did. And, the process was that the House of Commons would bring charges against the minister, and then there'd be a trial in the House of Lords. And in the English version, impeachment didn't just remove you from office, it could have dramatic consequences because the criminal penalties were incorporated into the process. And, you know, some king's ministers actually were executed as a result of impeachment. It was little used until The 17th century conflicts between the Stuart kings, particularly James I and Charles I, and Parliament. And it was revived at that point, and with one particular, particularly famous case that I'll talk about in a second. It died out again primarily in Britain. England had sort of morphed into Britain by that time, by about 1800, because it was no longer necessary. Basically, the monarchy lost power. The king gave executive power to a cabinet chosen on the basis that cabinet had to have a majority in the House of Commons, and therefore ministers could be held to account in the House. You didn't have to go through this cumbersome impeachment procedure. If the House lost confidence in a minister, that was that. The minister departed, or the whole government departed. So there was really no need for impeachment anymore. But here are three English impeachments, or British impeachments in the case, the latter two, that are somewhat interesting. The poor Earl of Strafford. The Earl of Strafford was, Thomas Wentworth, was a protege and minister of King Charles I. He administered Ireland, which was in tumult in the early 16th century. Sorry, the early 17th century, for Charles I. Charles I brought him back. The House of Commons loathed Strafford. They were very suspicious of the king and his claim of having supremacy over Parliament. So they decided to go after Strafford. And he was impeached. The House of Lords was reluctant to find him guilty, so then they switched strategies and put a bill of attainder on him. And poor Strafford eventually ended up being executed, beheaded, in 1641. And it was a, you know, it was one of those great symbolic events in that escalating conflict between Crown and Parliament in that ultimately led to the English Civil War and the king losing his head a few years later. The next instance, the gentleman in the middle, is Warren Hastings. And this, it was really the Hastings case that I think kind of ended impeachment in England in a lot of ways. Because, as you can see, the trial proceedings against Hastings lasted for 7 years. And Hastings was a governor of Bengal for the East India Company, and the accusations against him was that he'd lined his own pocket and that he had been extremely cruel to the Indian population in Bengal. It seems it's not clear that Hastings was any more cruel to the Indian population than any other colonial administrator of the time. He had certainly earned the enmity of some very formidable figures in the House of Commons, particularly Edmund Burke, who some of you might have heard of. And Burke, Charles James Fox, sort of led the prosecution of Hastings. And it was actually going on while the U.S. Constitution was being written and implemented. Eventually, after 7 years, Hastings was acquitted. And I think historians generally look at the incident as having, in a sense, demeaned the impeachment process or discredited the impeachment process in the UK. And there was only one more notable impeachment after that in the UK, the last one. And I like to mention this one because this is Viscount Melville. Before he became Viscount Melville, he was better known as Henry Dundas. And basically, Henry Dundas ran Scotland for William Pitt, the younger, who had a long premiership from about 1783 to about 1805 or so. And Dundas was Pitt's man in Scotland, and everything that happened in Scotland went through Henry Dundas. And, you know, he was referred to as King Harry the Ninth, or the Governor of Scotland, colloquially. There were a lot of accusations, of course, that, you know, Dundas was on the take. And so when Pitt was out of office and died, some of the Whigs went after Dundas, who had by that time become Viscount Melville, and impeached him. But they didn't get very far. He was easily acquitted by his fellow peers in the House of Lords, and that was the last impeachment in England. As I said, cabinet government basically came to the fore after that. It was clear that the country had reverted to a constitutional monarchy, and that the executive had really become a cabinet that was accountable to the House of Commons, and you didn't need impeachment anymore to hold the ministers to account. The U.S. Constitution, of course, looked at British models. And, I mean, it's interesting that in many ways they incorporated things that were perhaps still true of the British Constitution in the late 18th century, but were becoming less so, like a strict separation of powers, for example. That was actually beginning to fade out at the very time it was put into the U.S. Constitution. It was fading out in the U.K. But, of course, there was a problem here. How do you deal with a chief executive? And the 1787 Constitution's whole reason for being was basically to create an executive branch and a stronger federal government. How do you deal with an executive, a chief executive, who goes off the reservation, who is tyrannical, who becomes tyrannical, in a sense, or despotic, or violates the law? And so what they had was to look at the British practice of impeachment and set up a process that was somewhat similar. Impeachment by the House, which in the 1787 Constitution was the only branch of the government that was directly elected by the electorate as it was then, and then trial in the Senate, which was indirectly elected representing the states. And a two-thirds Senate vote was needed to convict and remove. Unlike the UK, there are no criminal penalties for being impeached and removed, although you can be prosecuted later, but those processes are kept separate. The criteria named in the Constitution: treason, bribery, and high crimes and misdemeanors. Treason and bribery, we're pretty clear what those are. The high crimes and misdemeanors has always been the kind of catch-all part here. And as we'll see, what constitutes high crimes and misdemeanors has varied a little bit from various impeachments in American history. But also another bottom line conclusion: it is not easily done. It sets a very high bar to remove the president or any other federal official, because it's not just presidents that are liable to impeachment, as we'll see in a minute. This is a high bar. You need a large degree of consensus to get a two-thirds majority in the Senate to convict and remove. And I think we should always bear that in mind. Not only presidents can be impeached. In fact, most impeachments in U.S. history have been of judges. Judges have lifetime appointments, so the only way that you can act against a judge who has committed treason, bribery, or high crimes and misdemeanors is to impeach them. Similarly, executive branch officials are also liable for impeachment. It hasn't happened very often in that case. The difference is, the traditional constitutional difference between a presidential impeachment and executive officials and judges is that there's no requirement that the Chief Justice preside for non-presidential impeachments. There's also been a procedural change in those, which I'll talk about in a minute, a little later, to expedite them. But for these impeachments, the presiding officer is the president pro tem of the Senate or the vice president, who is constitutionally the presiding officer. I count 20 federal impeachments total in U.S. history, including the impeachment of President Trump. So it's three presidents, one cabinet member, one senator, and that was a case that actually demonstrated that members of Congress were not liable to impeachment. Proceedings were started against Senator Blount very early in U.S. history, about 1800, but the Senate refused to accept the impeachment but expelled him instead, saying that impeachment is not for members of Congress. And it set the precedent that members of Congress are not liable for impeachment. There are other ways to deal with errant members of Congress. One Chief Justice, Samuel Chase, again, very early on in U.S. history, about 1805, and one appellate court justice. And then the rest, 13 of the 20, have been federal district court judges. Eight convictions in all. Eight of those federal district court judges have been convicted, and eight of them have been acquitted. There have been eight convictions, eight acquittals, and three resignations out of the 19 impeachments, and then a Trump impeachment outcome uncertain. The only convictions have been federal district judges. The latest impeachment prior to President Trump was Judge G. Thomas Porteous from Louisiana, and he was impeached and convicted in 2010 on charges of bribery and perjury. Interestingly, one of the House impeachment managers was one Adam Schiff for the Porteous trial. An interesting case, because I have shared a platform with him and I've interviewed him, is Alcee Hastings. Judge Alcee Hastings was impeached and convicted in 1989 on charges of perjury and conspiracy to solicit a bribe. And after his removal from office, he ran for Congress in South Florida. It's a district that covers partly Miami-Dade and mostly Broward County, and he's been reelected ever since. And he is a very popular and charismatic individual, I would say. As I said, I shared a platform with him, and interestingly, of course, he voted to impeach President Trump. It's interesting that we have an impeachment as recently as 2010. So it's not been that uncommon for federal district judges. The states. I think I have to say something about the states. Is there anybody here from Oregon who could... Yeah, can you tell me why Oregon doesn't have impeachment? The other 49 states and Puerto Rico all have impeachment provisions roughly similar to the federal provisions, although sometimes, again, the trial court has varied. There, for example, New York, I think, has the justices in the state's highest court join the state Senate. All the states have it except Oregon. Oregon considered introducing it as recently as 2017. There are some Oregonians tried to get it on the ballot for a statewide initiative, but it didn't make it. All the other states have it. Four state governors in U.S. history have been removed through impeachment. James Ferguson, also known as Pa Ferguson, because his wife Miriam succeeded him after he was removed, and she was known as Ma Ferguson. They were famous populist governors of Texas. But Pa Ferguson was impeached in 1917 for misapplication of public funds and embezzlement. Jack Walton in Oklahoma, was impeached in 1923 and removed for illegal collection of campaign funds, padding the public payroll, suspension of habeas corpus, excessive use of the pardon power, and general incompetence. The two more recent cases, and I have pictures of the two gentlemen, Evan Meekum in Arizona. I don't know if any of you are from Arizona or remember Governor Meekum. He was impeached in April 1988 for obstruction of justice and misusing government funds. And then the most recent state governor to be impeached and removed is Rod Blagojevich of Illinois in January 2009 for abuse of power and corruption, and mainly for an attempt to sell an appointment for the state's vacant U.S. Senate seat. And who held that seat? Why was it vacant? Right, it was President Obama's Senate seat. And despite his wonderful hair, Governor Blagojevich spent time in prison. So the hair is still wonderful. It's a little whiter now. The standard House impeachment process. Basically, if the House opens and passes a resolution to open an impeachment inquiry, and then the inquiry is handed to the House Judiciary Committee, that's not surprising, as you've seen that most of the recent impeachments have been federal judges. The committee holds hearings, reviews evidence, and if it decides to proceed, drafts and votes on articles of impeachment. The articles then go to the full House. If they're approved by the full House, the House appoints managers. These are basically the House's prosecutors for the Senate trial. There's no specific number of managers, and they don't even have to be members. They generally are members, but they don't have to be. It's often said, you know, that in impeachment, the House is like the grand jury. I mean, I'm not sure how well that analogy holds up, but it's sort of the grand jury approving the charges, and then the Senate as the trial court to see if they bear up. The trial. On receipt of the articles and the appointment of managers, the Senate decides the procedure for the trial, and the senators are sworn in as jurors. A simple majority of the Senate controls all the trial proceedings. This is important. I mean, you may have the Chief Justice sitting up there, but the Chief Justice is pretty muzzled. Decisions like rulings on evidence, witnesses, procedure, basically it's 51 senators that decides this. For non-presidential impeachment, the Vice President or the President pro tem of the Senate presides. You know, these standards for like civil and criminal conviction, I mean, there's nothing binding here. I mean, some senators may have a reasonable doubt standards, others a preponderance standard. It's really up to them. The length of the trials, pretty astonishingly, has ranged from 266 days, and that wasn't even a presidential impeachment, to 3 days. Again, an important question which I think you get different answers to. Political scientists like me tend to say this is ultimately a political process and that the outcome is determined by politics. You know, lawyers are more inclined to view it that this is a legal process. We will probably revisit that point a little later on. Now, there's an expedited process for non-presidential impeachments that has been in place since the 1980s. The Senate, I think, realized that impeachment trials could suck up a lot of legislative time. And, you know, with a tight legislative schedule for senators, they wanted to find a way to see if they could expedite particularly judicial impeachments. They've never tried this with a presidential impeachment, but so they, from starting with the impeachment of Harry Claiborne in 1986, the Senate set up like an ad hoc committee would basically conduct the trial, hear the evidence, assess it, and then they would make a recommendation to the entire Senate. So all these judges who were convicted, Harry Claiborne, Alcee Hastings, Walter Nixon, Samuel Kent, and George Porteous, and actually Judge Kent resigned before he could be removed, the other four were removed, were covered by this expedited procedure. Judge Walter Nixon decided that he would have a go at with a case saying that the Senate had violated the Constitution and that his trial should have been before the whole Senate. But the Supreme Court rejected his claim on a 6-3 vote. They basically ruled that this was not justiciable as the Constitution committed impeachment proceedings to the legislative branch. Although three judges, I think, thought Nixon had a case, which is some indication that the expedited procedure is not regarded by all as being strictly, you know, as being constitutional. But it has been used. The Senate has found it very convenient. It is a way to do judicial impeachments without tying up the entire Senate schedule. So, let's start. I'm going to take a look now in a little closer detail at the presidential impeachments and the near impeachment. And the first was Andrew Johnson. Andrew Johnson was a very accidental president. He was a Democrat from Tennessee who was pro-union during the Civil War. And so the politics of putting him on the ticket with Abraham Lincoln in 1864 were very clever. And it was a good gesture by Lincoln, you know, about the future reunification of the country. Of course, no one anticipated that Lincoln would be assassinated and Johnson would become president for virtually a full presidential term. And Johnson was, perhaps not surprisingly, very eager to reconcile with the defeated South, and he was far less sympathetic to civil rights for freed slaves than the Republican majority in Congress, which was dominated by hardcore abolitionists like Thaddeus Stevens. So they were fundamentally at odds on the direction of the country and the direction of post-war reconstruction. It didn't help that Johnson had somewhat difficult personality. He had a short fuse. And, you know, he had a habit of giving very sort of hard-hitting speeches lambasting his enemies in Congress, which also didn't endear him to the Republican congressional majority. Now, the basis for Johnson's impeachment, though, was a piece of legislation called the Tenure of Office Act. And the Republican majorities in Congress figured out that Johnson was likely to try to remove the surviving members of Lincoln's cabinet, all of whom favored a much stronger, a much harsher reconstruction, they favored a real reconstruction of the South, guaranteeing full civil rights to the freed slaves. And Johnson didn't. So the members of the Republican majority in Congress figured out that Johnson would try to remove these individuals. So they passed this act which said that if a president, for example, were to get rid of his Secretary of Defense, the incumbent would stay in the position until Congress had confirmed a successor. That essentially obliterated the president's power to remove executive branch officials. Johnson argued, and I think most constitutional opinion these days would agree that the act was unconstitutional. You know, the test case wasn't long in coming. In early 1868, Johnson basically removed his Secretary for War, Edward Stanton, and clearly violated the Tenure of Office Act. He appointed somebody else. He didn't pay any attention to the Act's provisions. So, didn't take long for the House to vote 126-47 to impeach Johnson. They set up a select committee that drafted 11 articles of impeachment. Most of them came back to the same issue, the criminal conduct in ignoring the Tenure of Office Act. But there was one rather interesting article, which, remember I said Johnson had a habit of giving angry speeches, lambasting Congress? Well, one of the articles of impeachment was he had brought Congress into reproach, disrepute, and contempt by harangues, criticizing Congress, and questioning its legislative authority. Today we probably wouldn't see that as grounds for impeaching a president. It's an example of how one's perspective on what is impeachable conduct has changed in U.S. history. The trial opened on March 23rd and lasted for 11 weeks. Witnesses, it was a great spectacle. Like, they sold tickets for the galleries in Washington. Star witnesses were called. William Tecumseh Sherman was called to testify, as he had served, you know, under Secretary Stanton. And the final vote was a real cliffhanger. Johnson survived by just one vote. They needed 36 votes to convict him. They got 35. And I believe it was a senator from Kansas who was the key vote, and there were allegations never proven that he was somehow bribed to vote for acquittal. Johnson was a lame duck president anyway. There was no way the Republicans or the Democrats were ever going to nominate him for president again. He was replaced shortly thereafter by Ulysses Grant. I think there was a lasting impact in the sense that the Tenure of Office Act, I think, is generally thought to have weakened the post-Civil War presidency, and the Johnson impeachment contributed to that. In an era, you know, when presidents were generally weak after a surge in presidential power under Lincoln, I think much of this has been held to the Tenure of Office Act and the Johnson impeachment. The act itself was repealed, I think, in the 1880s. That nobody really wanted to have it around anymore. It was doomed in constitutional terms anyway. The Richard Nixon near impeachment. And this is a long and dramatic tale which I think most of you are probably well aware of. I've sort of tried to boil down. In February 1974, the House voted almost unanimously to authorize the Judiciary Committee to open an impeachment inquiry. By that time, there was clearly a lot of suspicion that the president had been involved in an illegal cover-up of the 1972 Watergate burglary. We'd had the Senate hearings in 73, dramatic televised moments, the Saturday Night Massacre, where he fired his attorney general, and then an ongoing legal battle over the president's tape recordings, which was going on in the background. And that ground on through the spring of 74. The committee tried to subpoena the White House tapes. The president yielded up some of them. They had omissions. He didn't give all of them, claiming executive privilege. They began formal impeachment hearings in May. And then finally, at the end of July, they approved three articles based on Nixon's obstruction of the Watergate investigation, violation of the rights of private citizens, including the burglary of Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist, which had become known by that time, and the refusal to obey congressional subpoenas. Now, the interesting thing, I mean, we've tended to look back at the impeachment of Nixon as being bipartisan. Actually, it became bipartisan very late in the game. As you can see from those votes, you know, there was a significant no vote on those articles voted in late July 74. Those were Republicans and one or two Southern Democrats who held out against Nixon's impeachment. What really sealed it, or what sealed his fate, was the smoking gun tape that came out, you know, pretty much at the same time, which had him on tape basically requesting that law enforcement agencies be used to cover up Watergate. And after that, it was at that point that his support collapsed among Republicans, both in Washington and in the country. And he left office in August, before the full House voted on the articles. So we come to the Lewinsky affair. And American politics changed quite a lot between 1974 and 1998. And as I said, it had become already much more partisan. But the pretext for the Clinton impeachment actually came out of the Paula Jones case. And Ms. Jones has sued President Clinton, alleging sexual harassment while he was governor of Arkansas. Her lawyers wanted to call other women who had been allegedly involved with the president to sort of show a pattern of conduct, and they got the name of Monica Lewinsky, who had been a White House intern. There's the whole saga with Linda Tripp, but the bottom line is that Ms. Lewinsky ultimately, under great pressure, admitted the affair and provided evidence to Special Prosecutor Kenneth Starr in exchange for immunity. Mr. Starr was originally appointed to investigate the Whitewater affair, which was something completely different, but the scope of his investigation was expanded to cover this. As Starr's case against Clinton set out in his very lengthy report was, that Clinton had the president committed perjury before Starr's grand jury in his testimony, and that he had obstructed justice by trying to find a job for Ms. Lewinsky using White House staff and surrogates, principally his secretary Betty Curry and his friend businessman Vernon Jordan. Starr's report was released September 21st, 1998, and it would be the basis for the impeachment of Clinton. In October 1988, the Republican-controlled House Judiciary Committee voted along party lines to open an impeachment inquiry. And then the full House voted to open an inquiry on October the 8th, including 31 Democrats, interestingly. Thought, that it was worth opening an inquiry. Interesting thing, again, about the Clinton impeachment is the public were very opposed to it. And in fact, Clinton's ratings went up the longer the process went on. But the Republicans, in an election year, decided to proceed. In November the 3rd, they perhaps got a slap on the wrist for it from the electorate. They didn't have drastic losses, but they lost 5 House seats. And that was enough for them to remove their leader, Speaker Newt Gingrich. They had expected to make big gains, and when they actually lost a few seats, Speaker Gingrich had to resign. Then the question was, do they proceed? I think there was some debate about it. Should they default to a censure resolution? But I think particularly the House Republican whip, Tom DeLay of Texas, who had become more powerful with Gingrich's departure, was very insistent that they had to proceed. And from, you know, from our interviews with Republican members on the Judiciary Committee, they were getting tremendous pressure in their districts, which were very safe Republican districts, to proceed with impeachment. So they did. The Judiciary Committee, chaired by Representative Henry Hyde, had only one witness, Kenneth Starr. They also sent the President Clinton 81 questions related to the Starr report to answer, which he did. On December the 11th, they voted for four articles of impeachment: perjury before Starr's grand jury, obstruction of justice, perjury in the Jones case, and a more vague article called abuse of power. The full House only approved the first and second articles, and rejected three and four. The carnage, as far as the Republicans were concerned, was pretty considerable. They lost their leader, Speaker Gingrich. His successor, Livingston, also resigned on the same day as the impeachment vote, because, of course, there'd been revelations about his private life. Henry Hyde also, I mean, he didn't resign, but his private life was sort of dragged into the media as well, as sort of collateral damage. So, I mean, the Republican House leadership took serious hits. The interesting thing is that the person who was most empowered by it all was Tom DeLay, who was the most hard line of the Republican leadership on proceeding with the Clinton impeachment. So they proceeded to trial in the Senate. Again, impeachment hadn't gotten any more popular with the public. Over 60% against it, and it was never likely that there would be anything close to the 67 Senate votes, even though you had a 55-45 Republican-controlled Senate to convict and remove Clinton. I think the senators, both Republican and Democratic, I think there was a lot of concern about the trial and what it would do for the Senate's reputation. And I think, but on the Republican side, the Republican senators, or majority of them, the Republican House members and the Republican grassroots demanded a full Senate trial. They didn't, so the Republicans basically didn't feel they were in a political position to support a motion to dismiss. But on the other hand, certainly the more senior Senate Republicans, including their leader, Senator Trent Lott, were concerned about the whole details of the Lewinsky affair and the president's private life being dragged onto the floor of the Senate through witness testimonies. So Lott and DeLay, and Tom Daschle, the minority leader, actually did work in bipartisan fashion to try to come up with a procedure that would, you know, have consensus among both parties in the Senate and would allow them to conduct a proper trial. And what they came up with after, you know, a couple of meetings of the whole Senate was what was called the Graham-Kennedy plan, after conservative Senator, Republican Phil Graham of Texas and liberal Democrat Edward Kennedy of Massachusetts. And this plan allowed the trial to start. It gave the House managers and the president's legal team 24 hours each to present their case. And then it allowed the managers to present a case for witnesses to the Senate. So the trial began on January 14th, 1999, and concluded with final votes on the two articles on February 13th. Neither came close to the required 67 votes. Everybody knew that at the outset. They did allow three witnesses. The compromise on witnesses was to have them, Monica Lewinsky, Vernon Jordan, and the third one was Clinton White House counselor Sidney Blumenthal. They all gave depositions where they were questioned by the managers and the president's lawyers, and those depositions were shown on video to the senators. And so, I mean, I haven't spoken to Senator Daschle, although I read his book, but I have spoken to Senator Lott about this. I did a profile of him for a book chapter last year. He's very proud of how he and Daschle conducted the Clinton impeachment. They felt that they came up with a procedure that had consensus in the Senate, that allowed for a proper trial, but that didn't damage the Senate's reputation. And reading Daschle's memoirs, I think he felt very much the same way. The questions that Dr. Campbell and I talked about in our book essentially were, why did this happen? Because on one level, it made no sense. The public opinion was so against it. Why did it happen? Well, I think since 1974, you know, the country had become much more polarized. And both houses of Congress had become more polarized. And party leaderships had become more powerful. And primary electorates had become much more powerful. Even though impeachment was very unpopular with the public, the Republicans paid relatively little price in electoral terms. They lost a few seats in 98, 2000. They didn't really lose very much then. Most of the Judiciary Committee Republicans who led the impeachment represented very safe Republican districts. I remember one gentleman said, you know, that he went back to his district, it was a southern district, and he said, my old girlfriend sort of came across the floor and said to me, you know, if you don't vote to impeach that Clinton, I'm going to slap your face in public. And he told that story very colorfully. But, I mean, others were quite frank about it. Said, you know, the hard vote, the more difficult vote politically for me, given my district, which a Democrat is never going to win, would be to vote no. And they had the House majority. I think the only member of the Judiciary Committee on the Republican side that lost his seat in 2000 was the only one that was in a district Clinton had carried. The others, you know, paid no electoral price for it. The safe political vote for Republicans on the Clinton impeachment was to impeach and for the Democrats to acquit. And this was true in both chambers. So the Clinton impeachment, I think, really was symbolic of an increasingly polarizing America. So we come to the Trump impeachment. And, you know, how many of us are really surprised that President Trump has been impeached? I mean, given the highly polarized atmosphere in the country, a highly unconventional new president, and ongoing questions about the legitimacy of the 2016 election outcome on the Democratic side, the impeachment of President Trump, I think, seemed like a possibility from the get-go. But it wasn't likely to happen as long as the Republican Party controlled the House. And even after the Democrats took control in 2018, the Speaker Pelosi was very wary of impeachment, unless, you know, she believed that it was only likely to succeed if she could get a bipartisan consensus. And it was clear that, you know, it would take allegations of really monumental proportions to get that kind of bipartisan consensus. So the question becomes, why do it? Well, the Ukraine phone call affair forced her hand. The Democratic House caucus moved rapidly after that revelation, including her freshman members from the class of 2018, and she could no longer hold back on that. An interesting difference, though, once that she had decided to open an inquiry, was that the initial hearings and witness presentations took place in the Intelligence Committee rather than the Judiciary Committee. I guess this was a reflection of, you know, the nature of the president's alleged misconduct in sort of asking a foreign power to sort of intervene in the 2020 election. Also, perhaps, I think, she felt that Congressman Schiff had more experience with this kind of investigation than the chair of the Judiciary Committee. But at any rate, that was something quite different as compared to previous presidential impeachments. The House voted along partisan lines to open the inquiry, and then proceedings did move to Judiciary. They went fairly quickly there. They only called four witnesses. It was a panel of constitutional law professors, three of whom thought impeachment was merited, one of whom didn't. And then they voted, and the White House got a chance to respond at the Judiciary Committee. They chose not to do it. They alleged that the committee was unfair, and therefore they weren't going to dignify its proceedings by responding. And then the House voted almost entirely along party lines on two articles of impeachment on December the 13th, one on abuse of power and the other obstruction of Congress. And I will wrap up quickly here. What's new here? Impeachment in the election year, first time since 1868, and Johnson was already a lame duck then. President Trump is very much a candidate for re-election. The role of the Intelligence Committee is new. The Speaker's delay in delivering the articles, which I think is ending. I saw reports this morning that they're likely to be delivered early next week, so we may start a trial as early as the middle of next week. It will be almost exactly 22 years since the start of the Clinton impeachment trial. Senator McConnell in the Senate, his line has been, we'll proceed as in the Clinton impeachment with the same procedure. You know, we'll allow presentation of the case by the House managers and then have votes on witnesses. The difference is that the Clinton impeachment, you had the whole Senate, 100 zip, in support of, you know, the Daschle-Lott compromise on procedure. This time, you know, Senator McConnell has his Republicans in line, and it takes 51 votes to set the rules for a trial, and so, you know, he is going to follow the precedent of 1999, but not with bipartisan support. I'm going to wrap up here, you know, with, I guess, some reflections on impeachment. And whether we are in fact now living in an age of symbolic impeachment, impeachment that no one really believes is going to succeed in removing the president, but which is undertaken for other reasons. The thing is, the two-thirds requirement for conviction makes impeachment and removal very hard. And I repeat again, you need an overwhelming national consensus, and it's got to be a bipartisan consensus, if a president is going to be removed. And in today's hyper-partisan atmosphere, it's very unlikely that that kind of consensus is going to be reached. I mean, I can think of some things where you might actually get a bipartisan consensus, but it's got to be really, really bad. the Clinton and Trump impeachments, I think, were in part a result of a sense of duty on the part of the out party, the party that controlled the House but not the presidency, that they had to do something dramatic to register their disgust at the incumbent. But without the serious threat of removal, what are you doing with impeachment? Is just another weapon in partisan warfare? And if presidents don't take it seriously, is it just going to encourage more abusive conduct? In a sense, it's like crying wolf. And so that when you get, you know, the really, really serious threats, perhaps you've undermined the device so much. The outcome of the Trump impeachment process, I think, could have serious implications for the future, both of impeachment and the American system of government. It's certainly, I think, no accident that two of the three presidential impeachments have happened in the last 20 years, and that it has been at a time when we have had an almost unprecedented degree of partisan polarization at the federal level. And I think I've said more than enough, so thank you very much.